The music you're hearing right now was inspired by space. It's composed by a Seattle woman named Nan Avant. She's part of a concert that's happening this very afternoon at Benaroya Hall. Origins, Life, and the Universe is the brainchild of composer and producer Glenna Bermer. Bermer and seven other composers each took up some aspect of astronomy and the cosmos, and they created a piece of music inspired by it. By the way, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. It's Sound Effect here on KPLU. Our show theme today is Star Power. One composer chose the Big Bang, one chose the life cycle of a star, another, who's obviously after my own heart, chose the Oort cloud, while Nan Avant chose nebulae. Translated from Latin, nebula just means cloud, which is pretty accurate. You know, they're just space clouds of hydrogen and helium gas and plasma. But it's hard to put into words the shapes and color and movement of a nebula. And for Avant, that was fine. She's not using words. She was using music.
I started with researching. I found everything I could and read everything I could on the nebula. And then I had these really great opportunities to sit down with Professor Bruce Balick from the University of Washington's Department of Astronomy and Astrobiology. And this was part of our process that the composers were invited to connect with a scientist and learn more about their subject that they were writing about. So I had these great conversations with him, and it was private lectures by Bruce Balick. It was great. And he's an expert on the nebula.
So now we're going to think the Milky Way as a whole. It's a galaxy. It contains well over 100 billion stars. But if you were to pluck the stars out of it, what's left would be a lot of gas and a lot of dust.
What I took away from that was his explanation of the nebula, and that it was constantly moving, constantly changing.
And so one of these lumps, it might not be much of a lump to begin with, but it contains enough material to form probably hundreds, if not thousands, of stars eventually.
Stars are born, stars are dying, there's dust floating, there's kind of almost chaos happening throughout the nebula. This constant creativity and motion is what I took away from my conversations with Professor Balick and from studying about it. And I incorporated that idea into the compositional style of motion and creativity. Since I got this idea of the motion and the movement and creativity, I decided to make the music itself into many themes and many motifs or melodies, and have it constantly changing to represent that motion. Life has come from like a meteor, and it's, you know, landed, and things are developing from cells and growing and finally, you know, evolve. And it made me look at things differently and look at life as being, well, because I don't know a lot.
Thank you.
Nan Avant's Nebula-inspired piece is called Bijou, and it's featured in the concert Origins, Life, and the Universe. We are going to have more information about that on our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Well, our show today is all about star power, our compulsion to see ever further into the cosmos, and to bring it so close we can hold it in our hands. It's all ahead on Sound Effect. Don't go away. A lot of us use equipment for our jobs, and you kind of develop a relationship with your gear, whether it's a trumpet or a drill press or a piece of software. Well, astronomers tend to have very special relationships with their instruments. Julianne Del Canton is a professor of astronomy at the University of Washington, and her first love was the Hubble telescope. Now she's working on bringing the Hubble's successor into the world and imagining what secrets about the universe it might unlock. And I caught her at her office on campus, and she told me about how Hubble loomed so large in the early part of her career.
I actually met up with one of my professors from back then who described something I said that I have no recollection of sending, but he brought in a picture of the Hubble Deep Field, which had just been taken. And he described me looking at it and then despairingly saying, "We're never going to understand that," because it was such a mess compared to anything that we had ever seen before. And what's amazing is close to 20 years on now, we actually really do understand quite a bit of that, what looked initially like a tremendous mess. It's a testament to what the new technology brings. You see things in a different way, and at first you have no idea what to make of them. And then as time goes on, you start to figure it out.
So the Hubble is in its sunset, and the successor to the Hubble is about to launch in a few years now, but you're working two steps ahead on the Hubble's grandchild, right? What would that project be, the proposal that you and a number of other astronomers and physicists have put forward?
So it's an interesting exercise because you have to be thinking about what science is still going to be compelling several decades out. So right now, the Hubble Space Telescope is operating, and it's only 2.5 meters across. Like, I mean, you really could hug it. It's not very large.
Would you like to?
I wouldn't want to get it dirty. Okay. If it came down safely, I would give it a gentle pat. But we're looking ahead. For now, we're calling it the High Definition Space Telescope. It would be a mirror that was around 12 meters across. With a telescope this large, the precision with which you can view things in space goes way, way up. One of our team members worked out that it was almost identical to the increase in resolution from an old tube television, the ones that people can't even give away on the side of the street anymore, to an ultra-high-definition screen today.
What are some of the things that the high-definition space telescope would be able to do at that resolution that Hubble cannot?
Right now, over the past decade or so, there's been a huge revolutionary explosion in the field of what we call exoplanets. Planets around other stars. It turns out that having a planetary system is very, very common. And we'd certainly hope that that would be the case. There have been ideas to look for exoplanets that go back, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. So this idea has been out there for a really long time. But the technology advanced to the point where people could actually start finding the evidence for exoplanets. And I remember probably 20, maybe 15 years ago, seeing a talk by somebody who was talking about what the atmospheres of extrasolar planets might be like. What would the atmosphere be like if you had a different kind of star? And I remember seeing this talk and thinking that was just so far out there. Why would you be interested in even studying this? I'm a late adopter in all things. I absolutely did not have the vision to recognize. I called this one completely wrong, because this was, it turns out to be incredibly forward-looking in terms of something to actually do. And people are looking at what might life be like around some of these planets. You know, how might something like photosynthesis differ if you have a very different kind of cloud cover or a very different kind of star? Then there's that next level of maybe we can actually search some of these planets for what we call biosignature gases. And the idea is that there are certain features that indicate the presence of molecules that really shouldn't be there if there's no biological shaping of the atmosphere, and maybe find signs of life, right? That would be really exciting. I go back and forth. That part of me feels like if the universe did something once, it absolutely certainly did it again. And so maybe forming life is actually incredibly easy, right? So part of me is very optimistic that, you know, maybe if we look at 500 different systems, then, you know, maybe we'll find dozens upon dozens of cases where we see atmospheres that have been shaped by life. But on the other hand, life is pretty spectacular. And so maybe this almost never happens, right? I mean, this is a universe of billions of stars. And so maybe it's a one in a billion shot, and that we can look at 500 different stellar systems and not find anything that indicates anything unusual has happened on any of these planets. And both of these are very interesting, right? They're deep philosophical questions. They're exciting scientific discoveries either way.
What makes them exciting for you personally, like on a gut level?
It's pretty cool, right? I mean, I don't see how you could not find this a fascinating topic. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you chat about, you know, even as a kid, right? You see movies about aliens. Are we alone? Hypothetical questions like, you know, do we have a soul? Or what is love, right? Are we alone in the universe? That one of those questions is turning into an actual scientific field of study where you can actually stand a chance of potentially addressing that. That's pretty amazing.
So you've had the opportunity, using Hubble and other instruments, to see things that no one else has seen before. And I don't mean just with your eyes, but I mean, you know, understand what's there in spots that haven't been just blank spaces in the past. What does that feel like to get the first glimpse into a piece of nature?
Well, I know I'm supposed to say that it's awe-inspiring, but it's mostly just fun. Right? So we work very, very hard to get those observations. And golly, it's really fun when it actually happens, right? I mean, it's like when you plan your vacation, right? And all year long, you're looking at the guidebooks and you're like, oh, when I go to Disneyland, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going on this ride and then I'm going to go eat here. And you're planning and you're planning and you get there and everything you've been dreaming about is actually true. And that's fun. It's very much the same for scientists. We make these plans, we have these hopes, and then we get the data and it's just cool.
Do you experience the, hey, I'm at Disneyland thing more often than you experience the, wow, look at what I'm a part of thing?
Yeah, I'm at Disneyland most of the time. I'm much more than the sort of, I have those moments of awe, but I have moments of just sheer enjoyment and pleasure from working on these things on a much more common basis. I think it's, you know, an analogy I've drawn for people in the past is with medicine or doctors or a surgeon, right? The human body is this absolutely amazing thing. The fact that this works at all is incredible. But, you know, you're a surgeon, you're cutting somebody open. Oh, look, I found something on his liver, right? It's a, you know, there's, you get down into this kind of more pragmatic thing. And so you wouldn't want your surgeon every time they open you up to be just gazing and awe at the wonders of the human body. And, you know, you would like them to get down and get to work and really enjoy the day-to-day associated with your job. And I think most scientists really enjoy the day-to-day, even as we do get larger satisfaction of, you know, participating in this great thing.
Well, Julianne Del Canton is a professor of astronomy at the University of Washington and one of the primary authors of The Call to Arms for the Next Generation Successor to Hubble Space-Based Telescope. Thanks so much, Professor Del Canton.
Thank you very much, Gabriel.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week's show is all about star power. So we're going to meet a master craftsman now. He's kind of a star himself, but the real star power comes from what he uses as his materials. You'll see. So Bob Kramer's workshop in Olympia is kind of like a boxy, corrugated hangar, and it's really loud.
So I don't know if you need quiet or...
Well, quieter than this.
Okay. I got some stuff in the oven. Let me finish that.
Sure.
And,
Kramer reaches his pole into a 2400-degree oven, and he pulls out an incandescent lump of raw steel, and he starts working it with a hydraulic hammer. Bob Kramer is a master bladesmith. He makes knives, world-renowned knives. He's been on TV and in The New Yorker, and his knives sell for ungodly sums.
This is a Northwest Clinkett dagger.
The surface has this beautiful wood grain pattern on it that I just haven't the foggiest idea how you would have achieved. How did you get that?
That's layered steel. It's 400 layers of steel. It's actually got meteorites folded into it. I'm sort of obsessed with meteorites these days. But the old legend of the Northwest daggers are that they were made from meteorite because there's no iron on the West Coast.
But mostly, Bob Kramer makes kitchen knives. Gorgeous kitchen knives infused with stardust that certain kinds of people pay $4,000 for and then use to chop onions. Kramer was not always a knife maker, but he's long been interested in excellence.
Was there a time, you know, as you were developing as an adult, like when you saw mastery in front of your eyes and you thought to yourself, that means something to me?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, I had a interesting year in the circus. So it was completely...
You mean the actual circus?
Yeah, I was in Ringling Brothers, Barnum & Bailey Circus for a year. And it was really an accident. I just went to an audition. I was living in Houston. It was raining. I went to an audition just so that I could spend a couple of hours. I thought it'd be entertaining to watch people that would show up for this. I had no designs on being a professional clown. And a couple of weeks later, I got a call that I was one of 60 out of 4,000 applicants to apply for this position. And they said, do you want to go? And, you know, it was fantastic. It was really exciting. It was very different than anything I had ever experienced before. The lesson of the day was how to hit somebody with a chair. It's supposed to be funny. And we were failing miserably. I mean, we were just terrible at it. And Lou Jacobs, which is a very famous clown, if you've ever seen the Ringling logo of a real kind of an egg-headed clown, that was Lou Jacobs. And Lou was in the wheelchair at the time. He's about 85 or 6 years old. And he's just watching the lesson, and we're failing miserably. And he goes, no, 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 that's not how it's done. He gets up slowly out of his wheelchair. He shuffles across the ring curb, pushes one of the clowns aside, freezes, turns and looks at one of the clowns, looks back at the chair, picks it up, hits him with the chair. It's hilarious. It was masterful. And that was inspiring.
And that's something that stuck with you as you started to go on to your next chapters?
There were, you know, people that were fourth or fifth generation circus, and, you know, I just saw a level of excellence and also something that was completely unique out of the doctor, lawyer, engineer track. And that was very appealing to me. I think at that point, I realized that I wasn't going to do a conventional career. And then I moved to Seattle, applied for a job at a new hotel that was opening at the time. Luckily, I was ignorant to not really recognize the name, which was the Four Seasons. And because otherwise, I never would have submitted my application. You know, my resume was 2 lines long, one of which was Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Clown. So, like, why would they hire me? So I just applied to this place, and I had to go buy some knives. Everybody had to have their own tools. I noticed that here was this kitchen full of really talented cooks, but no one seemed to be in command of their knives. Nobody really seemed to understand how to keep their tools razor sharp. So I just decided I'm going to learn to sharpen knives.
So how did you go about doing that?
So I flew around the country, was looking for cutlery stores, was looking for how do people sharpen knives, you know, to a high level. When I got to San Francisco, I found this little tiny cutlery store in North Beach called Columbus Cutlery. And when I asked Otilia, you know, hey, can I see some of the knives that you guys sharpen? And she unrolled about 6 knives. And these were knives that were clearly 8-10 years old, but the blades were perfectly sharpened. And then I asked if I could see their sharpening room. And she said, sure, come on back. And Peter was back there working. I asked him if he'd show me how to sharpen a knife. And in about 5 minutes, he took a knife from, you know, the condition it was in when they brought it to the shop to, again, this beautiful profile and finish and edge. And that was it. I was in this store for 10, 15 minutes at the max. But that thing just burned into my head, you know, like, I have to do this. I have to recreate this because clearly this is the right way to do it.
Wow. So how would you go about doing that? Like, how would you even just set out to start being a knife sharpener?
I needed a workshop space, and I also didn't have a car. So I thought, okay, I'm going to buy a truck, and I'll build my workshop in a truck, and I'll just drive it from restaurant to restaurant. Find the chef or the kitchen manager and say, I'm in the knife sharpening business. Give me the worst knife you have. And they'd, you know, usually find some nasty knife that they'd clean the grease traps with, or, you know, chip on ice sculptures or something like that, and say, yeah, here, sharpen that. And by the way, it used to be serrated. And so, you know, I'd take this thing out into the truck, but I could do that. I could re-serrate the knife. I could polish it so that you could shave with it. And I'd drop it off and I'd say, you know, I'll come back in 2 weeks if you like my work. Hopefully we can work together. And I think I got turned down once or maybe twice in the 5 years that I drove around Seattle sharpening knives.
Well, how did you go from being a really top shelf knife sharpener to a bladesmith?
So after about 6 years, I started to get a little bit bored with just the sharpening aspect of it. And one afternoon, as I stopped to pick up a sandwich at the grocery store, I saw a magazine on the rack. It's called Blade Magazine. And in the back of this magazine was a little tiny ad for the American Bladesmith Society. And they taught a two-week course on how to hand forge a knife. And I thought, okay, that seems manageable. It's $600. I just have to get my butt to Arkansas. And just flew to Arkansas and, you know, learned to hand forge a knife.
Did you have a knack for it right away?
No, and funny, I went with a friend of mine who is an engineer, and I mean, this guy can build anything, right? So he's the best in the class, and I'm maybe not the worst, but real close. But, you know, at the Four Seasons, we started from scratch. We would make stock from bones and then reduce it down and then clarify it and then make demi-glaze. And it might take 3 days to do all the preparation necessary to make a meal. So it's a tremendous amount of time and energy that goes into it. And then you serve this meal and it's gone in 45 minutes or so. And there's nothing wrong with that. But for me, I wanted to take that amount of energy, put it into a knife that would outlast, hopefully, me. And that was the appeal. Somehow I'm going to make knives the rest of my life.
What is it about a knife that you love or that resonates with you? Why not a sculpture? Why not anything else?
Every time I get to use that knife, there's a sense of pride, there's a sense of self-reliance, and also I'm really so into making steel in my shop these days. Something about it is just so seductive, you know? It's the fire, it's the tending of the coal forge, it's the smell of the coal, it's the fact that we're...
But wait, that doesn't sound appealing to a lot of people, probably. It sounds hot and smelly and hard.
Yeah, it is, but there's just something really primitive about it. It's fire, it's tool making, it's, you know, man as the tool maker. This is probably our oldest tool, a knife, right? Other than maybe a big old bone that you hit somebody over the head with. So I'm starting with basic elements. I'm starting with really pure iron. I'm diffusing carbon into them. I'm melting meteorites into it. I feel like a kid in a candy store. It's just fun.
So where do the meteorites come from? How did you get interested in that? And like, how do you even...
So the meteorite thing is, it occurs in several myths and legends and cultures. Imagine being an ancient man and it's a clear night. And then you see a shooting star, and then you hear the sonic boom of this thing coming through the atmosphere. Boom, boom. And you see it land not too far from you, right? You're going to go over and pick this thing up. Well, now that thing is magical. This is a stone that was sent from the sky. This is a thunderstone. And so when I started to get into the whole Northwest thing, First Nation people and these Northwest Tlingit daggers, it is a prominent part of those legends. And so I was just curious, like, okay, where do I get a meteorite? Well, it turns out you can buy them on eBay.
And I think people mostly think of meteorites as being rocks, but there's a lot of metal in them.
Yeah. So the iron nickel meteorites are the ones that you can actually forge into a tool. So I bought a couple. heated this thing up, put it under the hammer, and that one turns to cottage cheese. It just kind of crumbles, and so I got this hot iron nickel spilling out over the floor. But I let it cool, scooped it all up, and, you know, slowly massaged it back into a piece of steel and folded it and stretched it and folded it and incorporated some carbon into it, made a knife out of it.
It strikes me that you really have room in your personality for both the rules, the precision, the engineering and the science, but also this whimsy and wonder and fantasy.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I hope I never lose that. I think we can be most creative when we're in a playful space. If we're just in a space of seriousness and linear thinking, then that creativity evaporates. And so to be able to create some space where you can just step into it and play and not be demanding of the time is incredibly beneficial.
Well, Bob Kramer is a master bladesmith, and he runs Kramer's Knives here in Olympia, Washington. Thanks so much for being on our show, Bob.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming by.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. Today's show is all about star power. And we heard a little bit earlier about the hunt for planets orbiting far-off stars. Well, on our very first show, nearly a year ago, we met a woman who, before she had turned 30, had discovered four of these exoplanets. Sarah Ballard was a Carl Sagan Fellow at the University of Washington when we first met, and my producer, Arwin, insists that I describe her as a badass. And I do not disagree. Ballard told us how, after the struggles and the self-doubt that come with being a young scientist and a female scientist, those discoveries let her finally feel like the real deal.
I felt humbled, but I felt like I could proudly take my place among other scientists who got to feel humbled by the magnificence of the universe. Before that, I felt like I wasn't a part of that club.
So Dr. Ballard has popped back up in the news recently, and this time not for a discovery. It has to do with another scientist, a very famous exoplanet hunter named Jeff Marcy, who just resigned from Berkeley. That followed an investigation which concluded he had a pattern of sexually harassing students. As part of that investigation, three young women came forward to report they had been harassed. Just one did so publicly, using her real name, Dr. Sarah Ballard. She was an undergrad at the time, around 2005, and she says Marcy took an interest in her, she thought as a mentor. He talked her up and praised her talent, but later she'd tell investigators how Marcy had also steered conversations toward sexual stuff. He'd ask her to call him at home. It was kind of on the line of being inappropriate. And then one night, it snapped into focus for Ballard what was really going on. Marcy had given her a ride home in his car. Ballard says when they arrived at her place, Marcy put his hands on the back of her neck and began giving her a massage. She hurried away, and she went inside, and then found that she could hardly breathe.
The fear was first that it all was lies, and that I wasn't talented, and that I would have to forfeit that new confidence. And the other fear was that there would be no future in astronomy either, because there would be no letters. And it was kind of both of those fears, in addition to kind of a primal fear from the trauma of being touched sexually in, like, I mean, I wasn't. It was kind of the primal fear of being touched in a romantic way by someone who you did not want to touch you. And it's a horrible feeling. It's about 10 times worse than you think that it should be. It's awful. It's so much worse than the words imply.
So things died down after that. Ballard would go on to Harvard and then UW and now to MIT. Her career had really started to take off. But she was finding that Marcy looms so large in the field, she just couldn't shake her history with him.
For me, this man was not only another astronomer who was formative to my undergraduate experience, he also works in my exact field of exoplanets. It loomed kind of in the back of my mind that I might have to interact with this man again, and indeed that day came. You know, I mean, I had to kind of be a fourth-year graduate student. It wasn't until 2011 when I was having to interact with him regularly that I even kind of came out to my advisor, even in that very private context. At that point, you know, we had to be in meetings in the same room, which always caused me great anxiety. And it was only kind of that. You know, I had to kind of reach a critical mass of misery to really come out about it in a professional way at all. So I had been talking about it in therapy and in my private relationships since it happened in 2005. But doing anything about it, of which, of course, being a complainant in Title IX is only one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is speaking the words aloud to even one other astronomer. That was a, kind of a very, very long process in the making.
Are you able to say more about what it was like to have to sit in the same room as this guy after the fact?
Sure. The word that sums it up best is very conflicted. In particular, one of the times we interacted in the same room was one of the most trying times I've ever navigated as a scientist, which was trying to bring a major result to publication within a very large research group, and especially being an extremely junior person. So I was talking about this with you before, Gabe, about Kepler-19. It was bringing Kepler-19 to press that meant I was interacting with a lot of very high-powered individuals within this NASA mission. And there was a point of conflict sort of about whether or not I should be the lead investigator on this study. And in a room full of people with differing opinions, Jeff stood up and said, I think that Sarah should lead this publication. He really has done me good in addition to doing me harm. And no moment kind of sums that up so much as that moment where he literally helped me by putting himself on the line in that situation and standing up for me professionally while I was also holding in my heart these memories of him hurting me professionally as well in the way that harassment does hurt, which is totally differently than, you know, the kind of intellectual level. This particular moment really encapsulated how I feel almost about the entire story, which is very deeply conflicted. And I think understanding and accepting that they could be true at the same time was a major part of why I chose to participate in the Title IX investigation at all, and then why I also chose to go public.
So as you were thinking that through, what price did you decide you were willing to pay to do what you saw as the right and necessary thing?
I think that with the help of therapy and with the help of kind of coming out to other scientists, I realized that the strongest fears I had were unfounded ones. I was afraid that he would make me feel very bad, and he could do that still. By telling me that I hurt him in some way and all he ever tried to do was help me. So for that reason, I was afraid, and people kind of affirmed to me, he's never going to do that. You know, he's way too savvy to reach out and try to harm you, especially now, Sarah. You're not 20 anymore. I mean, one major feature of therapy about this topic is that whenever a person kind of undergoes a traumatic experience, there's often a sort of time travel that occurs where, even though I'm 31 now, 11 years of accruing personal relationships and experience in the field of astronomy, I'm still that lonely 20-year-old who's just come inside from being in the car, and I'm deeply afraid and can hardly even breathe. It was kind of only with the help of others that I assured myself that the scariest part was extremely unlikely. I had professional encouragement from very senior people in the field, not only in astronomy, but in exoplanets, who were saying that you have a reputation now within the field of being a careful and thoughtful person. People know who you are. You have some measure of power. You don't have zero power like I did when I was 20. I need to be the woman that I needed then. I needed a 30-year-old woman to protect me when I was 20. And if I can be that woman now for another younger woman, then so much the better.
Take your time for a second.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for giving me a moment.
At any time. We got loads of moments. I was just wondering if you had talked to the other women who participated in the investigation, or if you know who they are.
I have now.
Yeah?
Yes, I do know who they are. and I am in communication with them. That wasn't the case even a few months ago. And those conversations about who would go public and who wouldn't, I came out on kind of one end of that decision, and then other women kind of decided differently in their own kind of emotional calculus.
I'm guessing you're not surprised that this is very widespread in sciences and other fields, but
let me tell you, I wasn't surprised, but I was prepared for a negative backlash, which for me never occurred. It's still something miraculous to me. I had prepared in both kind of taking social media measures and also emotionally for a Gamergate type backlash, which, I mean, that would be much more intense and sort of violent than I imagined any backlash would be. But there have been similar backlashes against the women who spoke out about Walter Lewin, a senior professor at MIT, and so on. And I had really locked down all of my social media, like anticipating some kind of backlash like this, either from other astronomers or from kind of harm wishers on the internet. And I got two letters from trolls. Two. I mean, in comparison to the hundreds of positive letters I got, in some ways it still feels like a dream that I navigated it without more personal cost to myself, that I came out without more personal cost to myself.
So the theme of our show is star power this week, and that's some obvious connections with your line of work, of course. But it also made me wonder, you know, Jeff Marcy was a star in your field. He was
very
a celebrity.
So.
And how did that complicate both dealing with the harassment and the feelings around it at the time and the decision to come out about it publicly?
I've thought a lot about why this particular situation turned out so much more positively than others. And I think a major feature was that everyone kind of knew. I guess I shouldn't say everyone. There was a critical mass of scientists who already knew that Jeff was a serial harasser of young women, or that suspected as much. It was rare to find a person, after I would share that this happened to me, with people who would say, "I'm surprised." Most people would say, "I suspected," or "I've heard before." And there's something to an extremely public figure like that, where if it had been completely new information, you know, about a relatively minor person whom nobody knew, that might have made it turn out very differently. The fact was that he was well known within our field, not only for exoplanets, but extremely well known too as behaving very strangely and even harmfully, like around young women. He was well known for that. And I think that his fame also played a role in this receiving the publicity that it did, especially highlighted how he was kind of a short list contender for the Nobel Prize, for example, and how even individuals who can be the most famous are still capable of doing harm. In fact, these things aren't separate. One of the women who counseled me repeatedly, who used to be the head of the chair for the Committee on the Status of Women in Astronomy, one of our professional groups, told the New York Times that it's a story for all harassers, that you're not too big to fail. His fame also played a role here, where what it said to our field is that it doesn't matter if you're shortlisted for the Nobel Prize. We, as an astronomy community, are deciding you've done too much harm to belong.
We did reach out to UC Berkeley about its investigation, and they referred us to a statement in which they called Marcy's resignation highly appropriate. And in Marcy's own statement, he said he didn't agree with each of the complaints, but acknowledged his behavior was unwelcome, and he apologized to the women he defected. If you want to learn more about Sarah Ballard, including listening to that first conversation we had with her about discovering four new planets, you can find it at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. We had additional production this week from Shane Melling. The world's greatest interns are Warren Langford and Casey Hicks. We get web help from David Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. If you like the show, there's just no reason not to go to iTunes and subscribe to it. Really, no reason at all. It's also a huge help to the show if you give it a rating and write a quick review. You can also email your feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org or tweet at KPLU and at Gabriel Spitzer. And of course, come on back next week. We're going unplugged.
No, I don't know. I don't know what unplugging would be like. Even my kids are constantly like, oh, mom's mad at the internet again.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.